For sports fans, it's that special time of year when the professional basketball, baseball, football, and hockey seasons all overlap. So for our bonus weekend podcast this week, we're revisiting some interviews from the Leonard Lopate Show with athletes and coaches from each sport. In 2001, Leonard spoke with Bill Russell, the first athlete to win an NCAA championship, Olympic gold medal, and NBA championship all in 1 year. Hall of Famer Yogi Berra, who won more championship rings than any other player in the history of baseball, joined Leonard in 2003, and in 2008, Leonard spoke with Tony Dungy, the first African-American head coach to win the Super Bowl. This past week, Leonard interviewed NHL legend Wayne Gretzky, widely regarded as the greatest hockey player of all time, about his favorite hockey memories. Enjoy.
Here's a quiz. Who was the first athlete to win an NCAA championship, an Olympic gold medal, and an NBA championship all in 1 year? Well, I'll give you a hint. He was also the first African-American to become a general manager of a professional sports team and the first to ever coach one. Do you give up? Well, perhaps I should add that he won 11 championships in 13 seasons with the Boston Celtics. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1975, and no less than Michael Jordan has called him the game's greatest living legend. The game is basketball, of course, and the man is Bill Russell. In Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership from the 20th Century's Greatest Winner, a Dutton book, Mr. Russell, with the help of David Faulkner, reveals the lessons that helped him achieve his goals and that can help anyone attain success in their professional and personal lives. I am beyond pleased to welcome William F. Russell to New York & Company today. Hi.
How you doing?
Now, this is your third book. Go Up for Glory was published in 1966. Second Wind, which was written with civil rights historian Taylor Branch, came out in 1979. So why so much time between books? Is it that you're too busy in your retirement to write another one?
No, I just inclined to stay home.
Resting on your laurels.
Well, what happened was a couple of years ago, when they changed millenniums,
mm-hmm.
There were a lot of lists and things about assessing the 20th century. And like they say, who are the best athletes, who are the greatest teams and all that. And we were... I thought assigned to a place like we really didn't happen, you know. It's nobody did that. So it's like this legendary guys came out, beat everybody for 10, 11 years, and then disappeared. And that
was
like,
prehistoric.
Yeah, like it was a aberration.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of a guy, a friend of mine, came to my house for the first time, and. I was showing him the house, and I showed him my trophy case. And he says, "What's this?" I said, "It's my trophy case. And it's down in the basement, out of the way." And he says, "I've never seen anything like this. What are you going to do with it?" I said, "Nothing." And he says, it's not fair that you do that, because your friends and people that know you knew what you accomplished, you know. And it's one of the stories in the book where my grandsons, we're at Thanksgiving dinner, we're all around the table, and he says to me, "Were you as good as Michael Jordan?" And so I was the only one that laughed. Everybody else go, you know, they kind of worried what my reaction going to be. So in the book, I make a joke out of it. I says I got up from the table and immediately took him out of my will. But my reaction to what I said to him was, "You have the question backwards." Was, you know, and I said the only reason I say that is I was there first.
But it's people often talk about whether it's possible to compare athletes of the past with the present. I mean, we assume that
I don't think you can.
The greats of the past, the really great ones of the past, probably would be great today, and the great ones of today would have been great in the past. But it's those in-betweeners that would have been different.
Well, you know, I didn't very rarely participate in that kind of thing because. There's no way you can ever know who was the best, because a whole bunch of factors go into that.
Well, even when you were playing, there were these people who debated over whether you or Wilt Chamberlain were the best. You were the two dominant centers in a time when there was nobody who could compare. And I learned something really interesting here. First of all, on the dedication page, you acknowledge Wilt Chamberlain, your daughter, your father, and your best friend. And I would have thought that with that rivalry with Wilt Chamberlain, that he would have been the last person that you would have dedicated a book to.
No, first of all, we were never rivals between he and I. We were competitors.
Mm-hmm.
We played the same position, totally different ways, completely different approach.
Right, he scored 100 points in a game.
Yeah.
You'd never score 100 points in a game.
It'd take me, that's a week. No, but what I think I touched on in the book is I disciplined myself. When he came in the league, there were people saying, well, if he's getting all these, he's averaging, I think his first year he averaged like 35 or 36 points a game and getting 25 rebounds. And they said, well, he's the best. And I had to discipline myself that I would not do that to the Celtics, try to see if I could get 35 points. What I decided to do was to continue to do for my team what I did in the past, and I wasn't going to change my game.
Play to your strengths.
Yes,
but you did very well against Wilt. He didn't score his average.
Well,
against
you. You know, he had some great nights, and actually, one of the things we used to play the Warriors in Thanksgiving night in Philadelphia every year. Well, in the afternoon, he would come to the hotel, pick me up. We'd go to his house. You know, he comes from a large family.
Mm-hmm.
His brothers and sisters, his mother and father, and we'd have Thanksgiving dinner together. And then his mother graciously would let me go and take a nap in his bed.
Because there weren't too many beds that could fit either of you.
And then we'd go that night, and we just kicked the hell out of each other. And so, you know, it was I always had enormous respect and affection for him, and he was the same way.
And you say he was one of the reasons you also wrote this book. In
yes.
one of your last conversation, he said that the only way to accurately portray yourself is to do it yourself.
Right.
I hope that, I'm just guessing that you didn't want to follow his advice in every way. You don't brag here about your love life the way that he did in his book.
Well, he was a bachelor, and I was, I had a wife and three kids through most of my career, so I could never engage in that type of activity. And if I could, I couldn't talk about it.
Well, you're a different kind of guy. He was much more into scoring than you were. You raised your daughter Karen alone, didn't you?
Yes. Well, when her mother and I went our separate ways, she insisted on living with me.
Uh-huh. Were you still playing at that point?
No. I was retired. But I woke up one day with a 12-year-old girl that I had to try to raise.
Do you think that you did it okay? Did you apply in the things that you knew from basketball to being a father, or is being a father being a father?
Well, you know, that's one of the things all of us, our parents, neglect us. They don't teach us how to be parents. They do it, but they don't ever say, no, this is the way you do it.
Well, you were very close to your father,
yes,
but he
yes.
also, you say, drank a lot. And
no, he didn't drink a lot. Oh. Not my father.
Oh, I got that sense. Okay.
Okay. No, he was my hero.
He was a good role model.
Yeah, oh, excellent. He never did anything to embarrass me. And that's one of the things I like. You know, he was always a man that he took care of us, and he loved us.
And you were growing up in Monroe, Louisiana?
Well, we stayed till I was in fourth grade, and then I started fourth grade in California.
Mm-hmm. So but, you escaped some of the worst of the discrimination that you might have experienced in Louisiana?
No.
You just had a different kind in California, you think?
Well, I was in Louisiana long enough to know about it. And then this whole country was basically segregated. And that's with no exceptions. And that, I'm talking about nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, but my father and mother both said that I should never be a victim. Never allow yourself to be a victim.
Do you think that also led to your consciousness of civil rights? Some people are athletes and they say, I don't want to get involved in politics. But you have always, and you even wrote the book with Taylor Branch. Do you think that they're tied together?
Well, I'll look at it this way. One of the things, I never responded to being called a basketball player. I was with John Havlicek at the airport one day, and a guy walked up and said, you a basketball player? I said, no. And John says, well, why do you always say no? I says, because that's the truth. I'm not a basketball player. I'm a man who plays basketball. That's what I do. That's not what I am. And what I am is a citizen. And I will always work until I die so that every citizen has access to all the things that go with being a citizen.
But you also did focus very much on becoming a great basketball player, even if that was secondary. It seems like it was the obsession.
Well, see, that's what I talk about in the book, is that approaching a job or work is fundamentally. My father used to always say, if you take the job, and it pays $5 a day, give your employer $6 worth of work. And because any job, if you take it, can have integrity to it. But it has to come from within you. And to see how well I can do this particular job, it doesn't make a difference what it is. One of the things I write in the book is about, there's a young man, he was older than most of us, but he was kept our locker room clean at Celtics. And that was his job, is to keep the towels ready and everything, and to keep the place clean. But he never referred to the players as you guys. He always referred to the players as us, because he was part of the team, and him doing his job so well was that we never go to the locker room and have a discussion about the condition of the locker room. So never a distraction.
Did you bring that sense of team to the Celtics, or was that already there? Is that something that Red Auerbach had established even before you arrived?
It was there, and I brought the same thing.
Because you'd already been functioning that way.
Yes.
Through college, although you were cut from your junior varsity team.
In high school.
Yeah, and that seems to have been a key moment in your life.
Well, it was devastating. But the varsity coach, I got cut from junior varsity. The varsity coach, a little later, invited me to join the varsity.
And Michael Jordan, of course, was also cut from his junior varsity team, I guess, in high school. So maybe great players have to be cut from the junior varsity team.
Well, you know, I think it's basically you develop.
My guest is Bill Russell. He's written with David Faulkner, Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership from the 20th Century's Greatest Winner. It's published by Dutton. We'll continue after this. Back with Bill Russell, who is more than just one of the greatest basketball players that ever lived. He changed the way the game was played, and in the course of his wonderful career, he won 11 championships in 13 seasons with the Boston Celtics. He coached the team two of those championships. He was the first African-American to coach a professional sports team, in fact, and the first and only player coach to win two NBA championships without an assistant. Things have changed. He's the first athlete to win an NCAA championship, an Olympic gold medal, and an NBA championship all in the same year. And it goes on and on and on. He's written a new book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership from the 20th Century's Greatest Winner. It's published by Dutton, and it's written with the help of David Faulkner, who is a man who is specialized in writing books on sports. The other two books were more overtly memoirs or autobiographies, but this is almost like a stealth memoir, isn't it?
Yes.
You're using these 11 lessons to also talk about yourself and what you learned about life.
Well, what I tried to do was talk after I decided to write this book about, said we were a great team, and what does, these are the things that took made it a great team. You know, it wasn't that I talk about craftsmanship and learning your profession, learning all that there is that all you can learn about your profession. Especially things that the people that are observers are not aware of, you know, and how...
You mean observers like the general, most fans? When I go to a game, unless I have perhaps played or coached, I probably will miss things that the other players will notice.
That the players will know. For example, if you run into a play, our plays were always involved all five players. Well, the guy that's farthest away from the ball is just as important to the player as the guy that's shooting it and making the play work.
Because he has a role,
right.
and if he does his role right, that helps the play work.
Yes, and that takes a certain amount of discipline, but it also takes a knowledge of what is important. And it's like the discipline is to do something that you are not the immediate beneficiary of.
Isn't this what coaches are always trying to convince their players to do?
Well,
I always read about coaches trying to tell their players to submerge their egos and to think in terms of team and role. And the best teams seem to have worked that out, usually with a very good sense of team defense.
Well, see, I take a different... I always say, push the ego. Okay.
Ego equals MC squared.
In other words, I'll take my ego and our goal. And so my ego will become a team ego rather than an individual ego.
Mm-hmm.
And that I can do what I do and show that how good a player I am within the framework of a team.
And the championship rings kind of acknowledge that, don't they? They have inscribed on them teamwork and pride.
Yes.
So, obviously, other people have thought about this.
The players designed that ring.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we got ready to have the championship ring designed, Red brought us together, and we said, this is two things we wanted on there, because we want to take pride in what we do, and we only can do that, express that through teamwork.
So that's another Celtic legacy.
Right. And see, what we talk a lot about the Celtic pride, which is a culture.
Well, it was a culture. Right
now,
there's not too much pride in Boston these days.
Well, but see, the thing is that you don't have to win the championship to be successful in that you're doing the best you can and you're doing it the right way. Now, sometimes you can do things the best you can do the right way, and you won't win a championship. But within your organization, you will have a multitude of good things going on.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
But you also have to have talent. You,
yes.
You say you don't believe in words like luck and accident.
No.
But no, you were lucky. Weren't you your genes a fortunate thing in your case? If you hadn't been 6'10", none of this, and not only 6'10", but there were a lot of tall guys. I remember Walt Dukes. He was always, and Ray Felix. They were always on the ground because they were tall, but they couldn't really coordinate their bodies. You had that great physical coordination and height.
Well, you see, I don't consider that luck. I got these genes. That's what I got from my folks. But everybody has genes, and if they were fortunate, they can find out what they can do. I found out what I could do with these genes. You see, just having them without taking and finding out what they are and how to use them, they would, I would know.
So if you had been born 5'10 instead of 6'10, you think you still would have
I may have been successful in another field.
Mm-hmm. Because the lessons you say that you've learned apply to right. No matter what you do.
Right. You see, Einstein was we all acknowledge a genius in mathematics. Then we have guys like the guys on Wall Street that are genius in finance and et cetera. They have special talents, but they wanted to find out what they are, cultivate them, and then apply them.
You tell an interesting story about your high school coach, George Poles. He inherited the basketball team, and he didn't know anything about basketball.
He had never watched basketball. He was a baseball coach, and a great one. In fact, at one time, he had 13 players in the major leagues.
Wow.
And this was in the 50s. One of his baseball players is Frank Robinson, who was a teammate of mine in high school. And he was the first African-American to manage in the major leagues.
So two guys on the same team wound up being the two
yes.
first in two different sports.
Yes.
Wow.
We had a...
That must have been some school.
Yeah, it was. It was. We had... We had Jimmy Hines, who won the gold medal in Mexico. Kurt Flood, Vader Pinson.
Mm-hmm. Kurt Flood, the first man for free agency.
Right.
So a lot of firsts from this school.
Right.
Veda Pinson, too.
Yes. Well, we had quite a few. Paul Silas, who's coaching now in North Carolina, same high school. And so for a period of time, of all the successful athletes, we had more guys that were successful in the community and in business than successful athletes.
But you say that George Poles actually taught himself the game by reading three rule books.
Yeah.
And then his drive, of course, ability to motivate players.
First of all, he was really a good person. In fact, George Poles was a white guy. And he was the only guy at the time that would let the baseball players play for, black baseball players play for his American Legion team. The other ones wouldn't. You know, mm-hmm. so that what he did, he went to the library and got all the books he could get on basketball. It was three books, two coaches' books and one rule books. So the first thing we did was learn the rules. And at the end of the first week of practice, we had to pass a test on. We had to know all the rules. See, because the rules, most people think of the rules as telling you what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules also tell you what you can do. And from the rule book, that's where I learned how to play. Because it tells you you can do this, you can do this, and you can do that.
You think that when you coach, did you do the same thing? Have your players learn the rule book?
Well, by the time I got them, if they didn't know the rules.
They were in trouble. I suspect some players still don't know all the rules.
Well, we had a saying where you can tell a smart player from a player's not real smart. If a player does not know the play when he's supposed to shoot.
Yeah, that's a dumb one. Or that's Charlie Ward. Russell Rules is Bill Russell's new book written with David Faulkner. It's published by Dutton. You're listening to New York and Company on AM 820 WNYC. We're live online at WNYC.org. Well, when you came to the Celtics, the NBA was largely white. You weren't the first black player, but you were one of the first. And I remember some years back when Tommy Heinsohn, one of your teammates, got in some trouble for making a remark that was seen as racial stereotyping. And he probably is far from a racist. But was there tension? Did things have to be overcome to the point where teamwork could be...
Not in that organization.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you why. The Celtics were the first team to draft a black player, or to sign a black player. They were the first team to draft a player from the Negro Colleges the first round, Sam Jones.
Mm-hmm.
They were the first team to start 5 black players, the first team to hire a black coach.
That's because Red Auerbach went to my high school, Eastern District High School in
Williamsburg. Well, Walter Brown, the original owner of the Celtics, after he signed Chuck Cooper, he said the Celtics will never do anything to embarrass their players, no matter who the players are. Now, he said that this was like in the 40s when he said that. And so the Celtics have always tried to find the best person for the job, period.
Well, I remember reading Red Auerbach saying that he was not sure to draft you. And then, of course, when he did draft you, you just changed the whole team and changed the nature of the game.
Well, you know, Red had the center that he had the year before was an all-star and an Irish Catholic in Boston, which is...
good match for the Celtics.
Yeah. And... Red had to trade him to get the second draft pick. And he couldn't, because he couldn't get the first draft pick. And he was worried maybe the people with the first draft pick might pick me, but they were discouraged to do that. And what he wanted from me was very easy for me to do. But I'll go back to what my father told me. When somebody pays you $5, give them $6 worth of work. Well, I gave him much more than he expected.
And that's the one thing that nobody can tell during when they're drafting in any sport. They can tell if somebody has talent, has ability, has done well in college, but they can't know what's in a person's heart until they actually have them on the team.
Well, you know, you get there are a lot of things involved, and that's why I talk about some of the things I do in the book. It's about how do you, okay, now, the Red gets all these good players, and the good players don't always make a good team. You can have good players and a good coach and not have a good team because you have to develop a system that all these players you get can operate in that system without changing. You see, now you get
it. I mean, without changing what they do.
Yes.
You don't want to fit the players to the system. You want to fit the system to the players'
talent. If the system is versatile enough, the player doing what he does can fit in. And that's one thing I talk about is inclusion. For example, the key guys to our championships are myself, Cousy, Sherman, Sam Jones, Frank Ramsey, Tom Heinsohn, Sat Sanders, all these guys.
Casey Jones.
Casey. Now, Frank Ramsey played for Adolph Rupp in Kentucky. Now, the only significance of that is Frank Ramsey was introduced to a game of basketball, a style, of what's important and all that kind of stuff. Well, that is different than Cousy in New York. He's introduced to a style that the New York style, okay? Now, I'm from the West Coast. I've never seen any one of these guys play or that style played, okay? So now I come here with the West Coast style. Now, the beauty of what Red did was he took all these styles and didn't try to change anybody's style. But we all learned from the other guys, and so that we blended those styles into a team that was so versatile that you couldn't find a place that you could put your thumb on and stop it.
In the introduction to the book, you say that when people ask you how you think the Celtics of your era would have done against Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls, you reply, we would have won in a walk. But wasn't that team emerging of all the styles of the players in the same way? Doesn't Phil Jackson coach that way?
Yes. And he was, they were an excellent team. Now,
Think that the Celtics were better?
Well, first of all, you got to say that they're a great team. And that's one of the things you have to count on when you're going to beat a great team, is that they're great. Because what makes people and great is consistency. And they do things well. Well, when people do things well and consistently, they are predictable if you understand what they're doing. Okay. So now, for example, in my fourth year in the league, I had Casey Jones, Sam Jones, Bill Sherman, and Bob Cousy in my guards. It was a 10-man squad, 4 guards, 4 forwards, and 2 centers. All 4 of my guards are in the Hall of Fame now. So that when you go to the bench, you didn't get hurt. Mm-hmm. You understand me? Okay. I was playing between 46 and 48 minutes a game. And I had Tom Heinsohn.
So what was the other center doing? Sitting on the bench the whole time?
Yeah. Collecting the check.
2 minutes a game at most.
Well, yeah. But that's... from our guys, we always got... Those 2 minutes were high quality. And then we knew how to play teams with a star.
But in those days, you also were playing fewer teams. So by the end of the season, you probably knew even at the beginning of the season, because you played these guys year in and year out, you knew every move that every player you were playing against had, didn't you?
Yeah, but I'll give you an example of why that's... in 1964, we took a team behind the Iron Curtain. Bob Pettit, Jerry Lucas, Oscar Robertson, Casey Jones, Bob Cousy, Tom Heinsohn, myself.
Good team.
Yeah. So we go behind the Iron Curtain. And so we get ready to start playing. And Red says, well, I don't know what kind of plays we're going to use. You know, this team has never played together. And Bob Pettit said, we'll use the Celtic plays. Everybody knows them. Okay. But, and it was true. We used the Celtic plays, but with the nuances and the way we applied those plays, the next year, those same plays would work against Bob Pettit right on, because he knew the basic play. Well, we only had 6 plays, but each play had at least 7 options. And so that, I think, I counted one time, with the 7 plays, we had 53 different things we could run.
We never even got into asking Bill Russell whether he thinks he would be a billionaire if he were playing the game today. But let's hope he sells a lot of these books and becomes a billionaire that way. Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership from the 20th Century's Greatest Winner, written with the help of David Faulkner and published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Had won it, Bobby Thompson had done it, and Yogi read the comics all the while. Rock and roll was being born, marijuana we would scorn, so down on the corner the national pastime went on trial. We're talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella, talking baseball, the man and Bobby fella, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Can you name the only player in baseball history to win 10 World Series rings? Well, beyond the Yogiisms and amusing TV commercials, Yogi Berra possessed Hall of Fame baseball skills. In fact, he was the anchor of a string of great Yankees teams for 17 years, becoming a 15-time All-Star and, as I said, playing on an unprecedented 10 World Championship teams. He's also the best-selling author of What Time Is It? You Mean Now? When You Come to a Fork in the Road, Take It, and Yogi, It Ain't Over. In his latest 10 rings, My Championship Seasons, Yogi highlights the glory years of the Bronx Bombers' record-setting dynasty. It's published by William Morrow, HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hi.
Thank you.
And you've said that this is a book you never realized you always wanted to write.
Yeah.
had been sitting there in the back of your head all these
years?
Well,
no. You know, they Dave Kaplan, who works with the, at the museum at Montclair University, he come up to me one day and said, why don't we write a book about your 10 rings? He said, okay, if you want to do it, go ahead. You know, we... And it took us about 3 months to do it.
So, well, you only have one ring on a finger. That's not a World Series ring, is
it?
Yes,
it is. That's 1953.
So that's the one you've chosen to wear?
Well, that's when we won 5 in a row. Uh-huh. 49's got a 5 on it, and there's only 12 of us that got this ring.
Now, there are very few Hall of Famers who've even won a World Series, let alone win 10. Do you think this is one of those almost impossible-to-match records like Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, the way the players change today, it can't be. I don't think they've ever come close to even.
No team could dominate that long. Teams now dominate for 3 or 4 years, the Braves longer, but they haven't won very many World Series,
right.
It all started for you in 1942 when the St. Louis Cardinals held a local tryout, which you and your buddy Joe Garagiola went out for.
Yeah.
Why do you think they signed him and not you?
Well, that was the year Branch Rickey was going to go to the Dodgers. And he told me I'd never be a ball player. You know, he said, you might be a triple-A ball player instead of a big league ball player.
But he was a pretty good judge of talent. Why did he miss you? Were you
that
bad then?
He knew he was going to go to the Dodgers.
Uh-huh.
At that time, you know, you call that tampering then, you know, if you do anything then. And he says, we'll get in touch. And I wanted a $500 bonus with Joe Garagiola got. And he just offered $250. I said, no, I'm not going to sign unless I get the same thing he does.
So did he try to sign you when he was with the Dodgers?
Oh, after I signed with the Yankees, he did. He called me up to report to Bear Mountains during the war. They go to Bear Mountains in New York.
Mm-hmm. You just was starting out as a minor leaguer when you were drafted. Did you see any action in World War II?
Yeah, I was in Normandy in Southern France invasion. D-Day was.
So if you had been with the Yankees at the time, you probably would have been a celebrity they would have sent around. But because you were a minor leaguer, your life was really not all that
well
respected.
I was only 17 when I went away and played ball. Anyhow, you know, I joined the Navy. They made me go in when I was 18 years old, so I missed 2.5 years. I come up to the big leagues when I was 22 years old.
Well, that's not all
too
that
bad.
Nowadays, that's even young for a lot of players. And that was 46?
40. Well, what really helped me when I came back from overseas, I went to the New London Submarine Base there. And we started a baseball team there, and it was great. I had Jim Gleason was our manager. We had there. We had Junior Thompson pitch for Cincinnati. Joe Glenn had caught for, and it's like a minor league, thing, like a Triple A club. We played some big league teams. We played the Giants. We played the the Browns, and all that, and Philadelphia, and that was like Triple A playing for me. That helped me a lot, and I got out. I only played a half a season at Newark. And
then the Yanks called you up.
Called me up.
And that was a veteran team. Most really cohesive. Were they close? Was everybody on the same page?
We're in 47?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Heck, yeah. You come up and see Joe DiMaggio up there and Charlie Keller, Phil Rizzuto, Snuffy Sternweiss. You see all them guys. You know, and that's for... I've been in the Yankee Stadium, but never on the field. It's great. I think a lot of people get that. A lot of players that have never been in the Yankee Stadium, they're amazed when they come in there.
Well, what's the difference?
Well, it's something, you know. It's
and yet there's talk continually about the Yankees leaving Yankee Stadium.
Well, it seems I don't know. I hope not.
It seems impossible to me. This is, it's history. It's the house that Ruth built.
Well, that's right.
And you met Babe Ruth, although he was retired by that time.
Yeah, well, I met him in St. Louis my first year in St. Louis, Missouri, and shook hands with him, took a picture with him. I wish I would have got his autograph. That's what I wish. At that time, we didn't think about the autographs like they do now. Be worth a lot of money if I had his autograph.
Well, what about all the great players you played with? I mean, when you came up, you were playing with some pretty incredible teammates. If you'd gotten all of their autographs, you would have done very well, wouldn't you?
Well, we didn't think about that.
I mean, Joe DiMaggio, Tommy Heinrich, Johnny Lindell, Allie Reynolds, Vic Rashi, Joe Page, the first great relief pitcher.
We never thought about that. This didn't start, you know, this autographing stuff didn't start till about in the 70s or something. It really got popular later on. But yeah, when we played, we didn't give many autographs. We gave autographs, but not like they do today.
When you came up, not only, I mean, the New York reporters didn't see much in you either, did they?
Yeah.
Milt Gross, columnist for the New York Post, wrote, as a catcher, Yogi is a hindrance to the players.
Right.
Were you really that bad?
I was bad. My first 2 years, I was bad. Until, you know, Kasich bought Bill Dickey in 1949, and he worked my butt off in spring training. I owe a lot to Dickey. I really do. He taught me how to throw the ball, second base, how to block balls, and
well, he was a pretty great catcher.
Oh yeah, he was.
Didn't he make one of the great errors of all time for a catcher?
No, not
not a pass ball.
That was Mickey Owens.
Oh, Mickey Owens. Oh well,
he was a good catcher.
As a batter, you've always been known as a free swinger. Did you have a hitting philosophy? Did you go up there with an idea?
Well, if I see it, I hit it. If I didn't, I wouldn't swing at it. You know, you could throw a pitch away from me, I might not have saw the ball as good. Next, you might throw it out again. I saw it good. I'll swing at it.
So that's why you didn't strike out much, even though you were a free swinger?
I hate to strike out. I felt embarrassed when I struck out. I guess you saw it in there. I was up 597 times the bat. I only struck out 12 times.
Wow. For a free swinger, that's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Then, and so here you are. Your rookie season is in 1947, and you're in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're playing the Dodgers, so everybody knows you. Yeah. The Yankees were going to win because the Dodgers didn't win a series.
Oh, I don't want to say that.
Well, they didn't win a series for another 10 years.
I know that. And, we played the Dodgers quite a bit, but we beat them, though, you know, quite a bit. And
well, that was Jackie Robinson's rookie season as well.
Yeah, we both broke in together. He was at Montreal when I was at Newark. We played against each other in the minor leagues.
So you win the World Series. Obviously, you did what all ball players do. You relaxed and played golf, right?
No. I didn't start playing golf until like my second year. Joe Medwick I played with in St. Louis, you know, going home. You know, I got $5,000 a year. We had to go to work. I worked a series of Robux when I got home.
I think Don Zimmer told me he did not earn $25,000 a year until he went to Japan.
Bobby did. I don't know.
Well, the most ball players paid terribly then, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the most I ever made was
$65,000.
That's the most I ever made.
And that was, your last year.
Last year, 63.
That was with the Mets?
No, the Yankees. I managed in 64.
So you did other stuff. You worked as a maitre d' in a restaurant. Sold suits.
I sold suits at American Shop with Phil Rizzuto. Worked in a restaurant in St. Louis before I got married. And then we came along pretty good. Phil and I opened up a bowling alley in Clifton, New Jersey. And we opened up a racquetball club when racquetball was hot then. And we sold that and we're doing all right now.
In those days, ball players really didn't have much bargaining power.
No, they didn't, because if you had a bad year, you got cut.
I think Mickey Mantle was given a cut in salary when he went from 340 to 320.
That's right. They knew it.
My guest is Yogi Berra, who has written another book. On top of all the other things, he's a prolific author. This one written with Dave Kaplan called 10 Rings, My Championship Seasons. It's published by William Morrow. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. So there you are, learning how to catch and playing with some of the greatest players of all time.
That's right.
And on top of it all, you meet your wife, who...
Carmen, I met her at Stan Musial Biggie's restaurant.
She thought you were somebody else.
Yeah, she thought I was Terry Moore, actually. Center fielder for the Cardinals.
And he was married, so she was not interested in you?
She said, I don't go out with married men. She thought I was Terry Moore. That's the thing.
Well, it seems to have worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, 53 years of it.
And Casey Stengel was your manager for much of your career.
Well, 10 years he was for us, for when I played, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's one of those guys who also is famous for coming up with an original approach to the language.
Well, he knew his baseball. If he wants you to talk baseball. He'll talk baseball with you. He used to get the writers on, you know, when the writers, he'll talk, double talk to them if he didn't ask the right question. And
that was his way of putting them
that's
on?
That's the way he did it. And he was great, Casey. He did a good job managing. He's the one who brought in platoon, like Hank Barn, Gene Woodling used to platoon. They used to get mad, but it made him play much longer. Barb really likes him, you know.
Well, a catcher usually is relieved more than other position players because it's such a tough position to play. But you were an Iron Man, weren't you?
Well, I played maybe because I was short. Didn't have to bend down too far. See, these tall catchers, they got to work. They got to get down real low. I didn't. I stayed in the middle of the plate, and I was easy.
Well, I looked at your fingers. They don't look mangled either. I've met other catchers. Tim McCarver has a couple of bent fingers.
Well, I was lucky. I never had one broke. I never broke a finger catching.
You had some pretty great pitchers that you were working with in those years.
Yeah. Reynolds, Rashi, Lopat. We had a bunch of good pitchers, though. The Whitey Ford, Bob Turley. And we had good relief pitching, too. I don't think we didn't. You know, you get with Joe Page.
Didn't Joe Page kind of invent the concept of the relief pitcher, the first one?
No, I think John Murphy did with the Yankees back when DiMaggio days in there. That's when it started, I think, the relief pitching.
Because before then, you just brought in one of the pitchers from the bullpen. But Joe Page, I guess he was the one that I grew up with, and I always thought of him as the first great relief pitcher.
Yeah, well, he was. He come in and did the good job in the World Series. And Cazava, Casey used to say, you only brought Cazava in when we won the last game of the series there, where he stuck with him. He's a left-handed player. He could have reversed the guy. Casey always believed. He said, if a guy can't get a, you know, if I'm a right-handed pitcher, and he'll say, if I'm a right-handed pitcher, you can't get a left-handed hitter out, you shouldn't be in the big leagues. He didn't believe in that.
Lefty-righty thing. What about you? Because the catcher is really the field general. Mm-hmm. You pretty much control the game, don't you?
Yeah, I did.
And that's why a lot of catchers don't want to give up catching, because even though it's very physically difficult, they have a relationship to the game that no other player has.
Well, sometimes pitchers, you get mad at them. You know, they think they know the whole game. They think they're smart. They're only in every fifth day. We're catching every day. We know what guys do. You know, we have meetings sometimes. One pitcher say he can't hit a curveball, and I'll pop up and say, yeah, he can't hit your curveball, but he could hit his. I watched it a lot. You know, I learned a lot by observing a lot.
You also were known as a talker.
I talked to the hitters. I did.
Was it a psychological thing?
No, that's it. But a lot of people thought I talked to them when the ball was on the way. I didn't. I talked to them before I even gave the sign. I would tell them where you're going. I even threw dirt in their shoes for them to just keep them happy. And
Were you trying to get them upset? Or
no,
hey, what are you doing after the game?
Yeah, what are you doing after the game? Like Ted Williams, he hated me to talk to him. Mm-hmm. He didn't like it.
Well, he was the most focused hitter probably ever was.
He was.
What about umpires? Can you talk to umpires?
Yeah, I could talk to them. There are a lot of people, I thought I was arguing with umpires when I turned around. I was asking, where are you going tonight, Mac or whatever your name is, and they get along. I just liked it. You know, it kept me in the game, like loose. Like in the outfield was boring. Nobody out there to talk to.
Yeah, you could only talk to the fans. Mm-hmm. Well, you're also, catchers go out and talk to pitchers, and many people wonder what they're actually saying.
Well, you go out there, pitchers are very funny. You could get on some of them, some you can't. You know, you got to baby them a little bit, some of them. And Rashi, he pitched better when he got him mad.
He was also a bit paranoid, wasn't he? He was convinced that they were always stealing his signs.
No, yeah. Well, we started using a scoreboard sign. That's what we did. We used scoreboard. Now, I don't think anybody uses that today.
In other words, you mixed up the
well,
some of the numbers.
Well, you start off even as a fastball. The game is nothing, you know, no balls, no strikes. It's even. That's a fastball. If it's an odd, if it's 1-0, It's odd. Not unless you want to change it to a fastball, you have a switch sign on. Mm-hmm. You change it that way. You could put anything down you want, but you go by odd and even.
And unless somebody knows what you're doing there, they can never steal those signs. It.
You still put fingers down, but that don't mean anything.
Now, why do you think the Yankees were able, year in and year out, to bring up these great ball players?
Well, we made good deals, I think, and we had good ball players. You know, we didn't have a bad team. You know, we got Roger Maris. You know, they say Kansas City was our minor league club, but we got Ditmore and from Kansas City. But we gave up some pretty good ball players to them, and George Weiss was very tricky. He made some good deals, you know, and all that. And the pitching, look, we traded my first year. We traded Joe Garden to Cleveland for Raleigh Reynolds.
Well, that was a good trade.
We got Lopez from the White Sox. The Whitey Ford's the regular man, you know, and Vic Rashi come up. He pitched with me, for me in Newark.
Well, it's odd that in those five straight championship teams from 1949 to 53, only 12 players were with the team from the beginning to the end. Today the conventional wisdom is you try not to mess around with the team.
It's going to be tough. I don't think that's why. I don't think anybody had a chance to win 10 World Series today.
You, for a long time, you kept your family back home, didn't you? When did you decide that New York was home base?
I lived 1 year on Girard Avenue in the Bronx, and then 1 year at the Concourse Plaza. We moved in with 50 in Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. You had a famous babysitter that you shared with the Rizzuto family, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, down in spring training, we did.
She's had a bit of problems recently.
Yeah.
Martha Stewart?
Martha Stewart.
How old was she at the time?
Oh, heck. She wasn't that old. She babysit for us in Woodcliffe Lake, too. Actually, McDougal's the one that introduced her. She babysit for McDougal's kids, too.
My guest is Yogi Berra. He's written a new book. How many books have there been so far? Have you counted?
Five or six.
Well, there are five or six books, and there are 10 rings. So that's the title of the book, My 10 Rings, My Championship Seasons. He's written it with Dave Kaplan. It is published by William Morrow. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When people talk about those days, they tend to either talk about the Yankees or the Dodgers, and the Giants pretty much are forgotten nowadays. But during that time, they were as popular as the other two teams, and there was a real rivalry between the Yanks and the Giants, wasn't there? Because the ballparks were so close.
Oh, very close. There, that's funny. We never had spring training with the Giants. You know, where they were out in Arizona. We were in San Florida, St. Pete. And Dodgers were at Vero Beach. We become close friends. A lot of people thought we were enemies, you know, the Dodgers and Yankees, because we played them a lot of times at spring training. We played them about six or seven times at spring training. And we became friends. We went barnstorming with them. You know, I've been barnstorming with Duke Snyder, Campy, Pee Wee Reese. We were all friends, but on that field, we were the enemies.
Mm.
After the game, you're fine.
Well, I remember when I was a kid, and there was a big debate over who was the best center fielder in New York. Was it Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, or Duke Snyder? Now, I was a Dodger fan, and I said Duke Snyder. And Duke Snyder laughs at that now because he's a Hall of Fame player. He says the other two were better, and he thinks Willie Mays was the greatest center fielder he ever saw.
Well, it was tough. We never saw him. Willie Mays that much. See, to me, DiMaggio was the best I saw. 5 years I played with Joe, and I never seen him make a mistake. He just knew the ball game. You know, when you see these guys sliding for balls on the ground, DiMaggio caught everything up here. He never slipped for a ball.
He just moved immediately at the crack of the bat. He seemed to know where to go.
He just had the instinct. I don't know why he did it, but he did.
There was a biography of him recently which depicted him as a rather cold guy.
No, to me he was very close. The cold guy. He's a loner. He was a loner. He didn't like to be with anybody. He liked to invite you out to dinner. You know, you try to pick up the check. He said If you pick it up, you ain't going to come out with me anymore. But he liked company. If he knew you real good, he'll talk to you. But if he didn't like you, because he used to get off the train by himself, catch a cab and go to the hotel. We didn't care what he did, as long as he got to the ballpark every day.
Because he was one of the greatest players and a great fielder, a great hitter. Did you have roommates all the time?
Not all. Well, I had a couple of them. I had Bobby Brown, Phil Rizzuto, and Whitey Ford. Then we finally got our own room. I know that's probably the one thing that when Whitey Ford, I didn't wake him up. He was pitching in Chicago. He got there just in time for the game.
You also were blamed for almost blowing a no-hitter for Allie Reynolds.
Yeah.
Life magazine.
When I dropped it, yeah. Said
Yogi the Goat, Yogi the Hero. Well, Life magazine could do a two-page picture spread about you then. I doubt that would happen today.
You know who was up, too? Was it Ted Williams. And I went out and talked to, when I dropped the first one, Ollie Reynolds said, "Are you all right? I fell backwards on it." I said, "No, you stepped on my hand." I said, "When I just fell down," and I said, "I'm going to call the same pitch, Ollie, the same place. If you could throw it there," and he threw it exactly the same pitch, same place, and he fouled it off at the same plate, and I caught it.
The Dodgers, you said, were friends, but you played a number of World Series with them. Probably the most exciting one was the 52 series, wasn't it? Because the Dodgers were really just an all-star team.
Oh, yeah. They're a good ball club. We played some good game, good series with them.
And Billy Martin was the big hero there. Now, there's another guy who is a mixed bag, isn't he? I mean, you wanted him on your team at the same time kind of crazy, wasn't he?
Well, Billy was all right. Billy beat you any way he could beat you. Even when he managed, he did that. He beat you any way he could beat you.
You played for 17 seasons, so you really saw baseball change, didn't you?
Oh, it's changed a little bit. You got 30 teams now. That's what you got. And it's tough to, they all say, well, the pitchers are not good. It's tough to pitch. Everybody's looking for pitching right now. There were 30 teams. Where you go? That's a lot of pitchers you got to put out there.
And there are just as many good pitchers. It's just more teams.
That's it. You don't find three good ones on one team like we did in the old days.
And you also don't have pitchers, even the star pitchers, pitching complete games nowadays. It's rare when a guy pitches a complete game.
It is.
I remember when Don Newcomb started both ends of a doubleheader.
I remember that, too.
You won't see that anymore. No. You caught Don Larson's perfect game?
Perfect game, yeah.
That had to be an overwhelming experience. Yeah, in the World Series of all places.
It's never happened before. He was great that day, If he had that kind of control, he went 30 games, though.
So what is it like to catch a game like that? Well, first of all, it's nerve-wracking at a certain point because that every pitch could be the pitch that ruins it.
Well, we only had a 2-0 lead, You never know what could happen. Man get on, the guy hit a home run, you're tied. We never talked to Don at all. We left him in a corner. He stayed there by himself. And we never did anything. Nobody talked to him. And he went out and did his job. He went to 3 balls on 1 hit, and that was in the first inning to Pee Wee Reese.
That was it?
That was it. He only threw 93 pitches that day.
Now, today, it's almost automatic. If a pitcher gets 2 strikes, the third pitch is so outside that nobody's ever going to swing at it. Why even bother?
I don't know. But that part goes. That ball was close, though, the one the Larson pitched. It was right out of the corner.
Mm-hmm. Right now, there's much talk about Mike Piazza being moved to first base, and a lot of catchers resist giving up the position. Were you happy to be moved to the outfield?
Well, I came up as an outfielder. I never caught till I turned pro, actually. When I played in Norfolk, you had to learn to do it. They say he can't move; he's not quick enough for something at first base. I don't know. You got to see for yourself what he can do. I didn't care where I played, to tell you the truth. As long as I got the hit, that's the best part of the game, hitting. Mm-hmm. And I play where you wanted me to play, I play.
When did you know that it was time to quit?
When I struck out 3 times.
I've struck out three times
in my life.
That's the same game?
That's in the same game.
Did you know that you'd want to continue working as a working in baseball? Your first a player coach.
No, that's all I knew. I loved baseball, and when I got out of that, I stayed coaching. You know, I was coach then with the Mets. Then I was with them for 10 years. Then,
well, you managed the Yankees. You managed the Mets.
Yep.
You managed Tom Tresh, and we're not even going to talk about that.
Tom.
So you did other things. You appeared in a movie with Grace Kelly and Cary Grant.
Touch of Mink.
You had Yoo-Hoo.
Yoo-Hoo.
You could have probably have continued working outside of baseball.
Well, we could have. Well, I did. You know, Phil and I opened a bowling alley in Clifton, New Jersey. And then I opened up a racquetball club in Fairfield, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Route 46.
And I understand that one of the things you're most proud of is the museum and learning center built in your honor at Montclair State University in New Jersey. That's where your 10 rings are displayed?
That's where they're displayed. You know, a lot of people said, boy, it's a very nice museum. I said, I'm lucky to see it. Usually when you get a museum, you're dead. You know, they put you, you're not alive when they do that. And I'm still alive and looking at it. It's a nice museum. If anybody got a chance to see it, it's worth a ride.
And do you feel relieved that you've made up with the Yankees?
Oh, yeah. Oh, George's been very good so far. He's been real good.
Well, you've been wonderful. You've been a wonderful guest. I want to thank you so much, Yogi, for being with us. Yogi Berra, his book, 10 Rings, My Championship Seasons, written with Dave Kaplan and published by William Morrow. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tony Dungy wears many hats. Most notably, he led the Indianapolis Colts to the 2006 Super Bowl championship. He's also earned widespread respect off the field for his work in the community. And he's even been a number one New York Times best-selling author. His newest book is for children, ages 4 to 7, and it's called You Can Do It. It's illustrated by Amy June Bates and published by Little Simon Inspirations. It is my great pleasure to welcome Tony Dungy to the show today. Hi, Coach.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great being here with you. This is quite a privilege.
Have you always been interested in writing books?
I really hadn't. My mom was an English teacher, and that was one of the things that I never really got into. And I never thought I would, but after the Super Bowl, got a lot of requests to maybe do something, wrote Quiet Strength with a friend of mine, Nathan Whitaker, and it did really well.
Number one bestseller is pretty well.
Well, anyway, after that, we got a lot of cards and letters from people who said, you know, hey, I enjoyed the book. By the way, I read chapter 10 to my 18-year-old, and it really stimulated some discussion. So at that point, we thought, boy, what a good way to get parents to connect with their children, maybe direct a little bit younger age group, and come out with a children's book, encourage parents to read to their kids, and hopefully it'll go well.
Did that happen with you? Were you encouraged by children's books when you were a kid?
Not so much with books, but I spent a lot of time with both my mom and my dad, but my dad especially doing things together. My dad was a big reader. He was a science teacher and read a lot and would show me things from time to time and get me to read certain things. But spending that time together was what was critical, and that's kind of what we're trying to emphasize in the book.
So your mother was an English teacher. Your father was a science teacher. Were they disappointed when you became a jock?
They were, to a certain extent. I have a sister who's a doctor, a brother who's a dentist, and another sister who's a nurse. So for me to go into physical education was kind of a letdown, probably.
This book depicts an African-American family. Do you feel that there aren't enough books directed primarily toward African-American kids?
Well, that was certainly a part of it. My wife is a big reader. She reads to, we have young children. She reads to them. She reads in the community once a week. And she said, boy, it'd be nice to read things that weren't just fun books, but also had a message depicting family and that type of thing. And to be able to find for our kids, you know, hey, here's an African-American family depicted in a book. She struggled to find that, so that was certainly part of it.
What were the main principles that you set out to achieve in this book?
We really wanted to talk about family, number one, and how important it is for the parents to guide children, for kids to dream, but not have to feel like I've got to do what everybody else is doing. My brother in the book is torn because a lot of people want him to do what I did and be an athlete, be a football player. And he was really more into science. And so to be able to follow your dream and get that type of encouragement. And then also the faith part of it. My Christian faith is very important to me, and I just wanted to have that as an underlying tone, too, that it's great to dream, it's great to work hard, but you don't want to leave the Lord out of it.
So this is semi-autobiographical?
It's based on a true story. My brother really was 3 years behind me, really did kind of face that crisis of being the younger brother of a star athlete in a small town. He was a brilliant student, but everyone felt, you know, he should push towards athletics. And my dad and mom, I thought, did a good job of directing all of us into areas that we liked and we were talented in. And it is. He did become a dentist, and it's pretty much a true story.
Well, the chances of becoming a successful dentist are a lot higher than becoming a professional athlete, let alone a successful professional athlete.
They really are, and that's another point we want to make in the book, that you don't have to be an athlete or an entertainer to be successful. There are a lot of ways you can get satisfaction in life and do great things and help society besides being an athlete.
I read that you said you got more satisfaction from the success of Quiet Strength than from the Super Bowl win. Is that really possible?
It is because it was satisfaction in a different way. It was something that I never expected. Didn't expect the book to take off the way it did. And I got so many cards and letters and emails and have been in touch with young men especially that said, hey, this book helped me through a certain period in my life. Reading about your son, reading about your troubles growing up or trials growing up has helped me. And when you feel like you can help someone, especially a young person, kind of find their way, that's really a lot more gratifying than just winning a game.
And we're seeing a lot of athletes who have to overcome adversity as kids, coming out of rough situations. One of the reasons why some of them have had scrapes with the law before, they have finally been able to make it. So is that what it's really all about, becoming so focused that you can get past all of the problems that you grew up with?
Well, I think it's a societal problem. We're seeing so many young men, especially, you know, growing up in homes without their dad for whatever reason, deaths in the family, breakups in marriages, parents not being married at all. And it's so hard. I look at how my dad was able to influence me and what I saw from him, and I can't imagine growing up and not having that. But we probably get 3 out of every 4 guys who come to us, you know, from that situation. So being able to give a little guidance to mentor, where do these guys find it? And a lot of athletes, fortunately, do find it from their junior high coach or a high school coach that kind of believed in them. But if you're not an athlete, where do you get that direction?
So your job as a head coach is to also be something of a psychologist and a sociologist?
Not necessarily psychologist, but definitely mentor. And you know, I talk in our team meetings about a lot of things. I talk about growing up and life and living and the responsibility we have. I encourage our guys to reach back into the community of Indianapolis. And I'm very proud of our group. We have guys that mentor and volunteer at high schools and junior highs in the city. And it's needed, whether it's at a boys and girls club or one-on-one. We have several guys that are big brothers, and it just, you know, we can help make a difference in the life of a young person.
I just saw a documentary, an HBO documentary, about schools in Baltimore, a special school, an all-black school in Baltimore that had once been one of the elite schools in America. And the complaint of the teachers was that on parents' night, most of the parents didn't show up. The only ones who showed up were the ones whose kids didn't need help.
Well, that's a reason why they probably didn't need help, because their parents were involved. And especially from the men's point of view, I really can't stress that enough. Dads being involved makes such a difference. And we need to do that. And for the kids that don't have dads, whether it's uncle, grandfather, just a next-door neighbor, if you can help point that young man in the right direction, it's important. Our guys, our players, I tell them all the time, you may be the adult male that some young man is looking at and saying, I want to be like Peyton Manning. And if we're doing a great job on the field and winning championships, but we're not sending the right message off the field, we're not living the right way, and we're telling some young kid, well, that's okay. If you're a good athlete, you can do whatever you want. That's the wrong message.
My guest is Tony Dungy, who, among other things, is writing books these days, and his latest is aimed at young kids. It's called You Can Do It, with illustrations by Amy June Bates. It's published by Little Simon Inspirations, and the illustrations are terrific. Did you work with her?
That I found out in writing a children's book, that's the biggest thing, because you're going to actually be hitting some kids that really can't read the words, but they've got to see it from the illustrations. And working with Amy was great. We really liked her work, and then we told her the story, but then she had to learn about my family, and I had to talk to her, describe my brother, describe my dad and mom, who she had never met.
You didn't give her photographs?
We did give her photographs, but it's more in the personality and how a person, you know, really was. And without her knowing my family, she captured them really well.
When did you decide that you wanted to be a football player? Had you played other sports when you were young?
Yeah, basketball was really my favorite sport growing up. I think I started playing baseball. I remember playing catch with my dad when I was 3 or 4 years old, and then going into basketball. Football was actually the last sport that I took up, and basketball was always my love. In the middle of my sophomore year in college, I just came to the realization I was going to be a little bit better in football than basketball and kind of concentrate on it from there. But never thought about being a professional athlete until I was probably a junior in college.
And as a quarterback at the University of Minnesota, you became one of the best offensive players in Big Ten history. So why weren't you drafted right out of college?
Well, I was a different type of quarterback at that time in the late 70s. Had I come out of school now, maybe would have gotten a chance to play quarterback. We're a little bit more into using different talents and having guys play in different styles now. But back then, I wasn't a prototypical quarterback, but I was a pretty smart player and ended up changing over to defense when I got to the Steelers. And eventually, that helped me in my coaching career, learn both sides of the ball.
But do you think race was a factor? Because there were very few black quarterbacks at the time. In fact, there were very few black middle linebackers at the time.
It was that time of the NFL development. If you weren't the prototypical, I think they tended to look for other places that you could play. There were two or three black quarterbacks at that time. And I always kind of look back and wish I had gotten a chance to play quarterback, but in the final analysis, I think the Lord was training me to be a coach, and it worked out great for me anyway.
Because you've seen the game from both sides.
Both sides. And I got a chance to play in Pittsburgh when they were at the height of their heyday, and then I got traded to the 49ers, who were just starting. They were at the bottom of the barrel. So I saw both sides of it. I saw Chuck Noll with a championship team, and I saw Bill Walsh kind of build the team from the ground up. And that certainly helped me when I took over in Tampa.
Well, how difficult was it to make the transition to safety from having been a quarterback? I mean, if you had been a pass receiver, it might have been a little easier.
Right. It was hard for me because I'd always played quarterback from junior high, elementary school, really, all the way up. I never played any other position. I didn't know that much about defense. Had never played. And so everything was new, and learning it at that highest level when you're competing against the best in the world as you're trying to learn, that was a little difficult.
Do you think some players really do well because they're just determined to do well? Others just born with an incredible gift. You were one of those players who seemed to be pretty dead set on succeeding.
I think mine was...
Not that you didn't have talent.
Well, I didn't have that natural talent that you're talking about. I think mine was the fact that I could process information quickly, I could learn, I was a decent athlete, but mine was more mental and preparation and working hard. as opposed to some guys who just are so gifted and can do things that no one else can do. That certainly wasn't the case for me.
My guest is Tony Dungy, who has followed up his number one New York Times bestseller for adults with a book for kids called You Can Do It, with illustrations by Amy June Bates. It is published by Little Simon Inspirations. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Coach Tony Dungy, who has started a new career as a writer. His latest is a book for kids called You Can Do It, with illustrations by Amy June Bates. It is published by Little Simon Inspirations. Does this mean that you're going to continue writing books?
You know, I do have kind of a vision for a third book. Someone I really would like to write to young men, teenage boys, talking about growing up in our society, what it means to be a man, pitfalls, kind of the things I talk to my players about.
Now, you've been involved in the NFL for over 30 years, both as a player and a coach. If you read the sports pages, you get the sense that players have changed a lot over the years. Do you think that's true?
I don't think we've changed a lot. I think we still have the same types of guys in the league, but the surroundings have changed. There's a lot more pitfalls for players nowadays. They make a lot more money faster than they did before. So you have a lot of people around them that don't necessarily have their best interests at heart.
On the other hand, it also can be claimed that the quality of play is a lot higher. When I first started watching football, a 300-pound offensive lineman was considered a fat guy, mm-hmm. and now he's considered maybe a little small.
Right. No, that has changed. The size, the speed, the skill level. I think we're seeing these kids develop weight programs in high school, weightlifting and nutrition. You're getting bigger, faster guys. You're getting people to train. My son is a junior in high school, and they practice year-round now, where we used to play every sport that came around. They almost force these guys to focus in on one sport.
So you got to choose your sport when you're young. Otherwise, you're less likely to make it. It's like playing piano. If you don't start playing when you're 6 years old, it's unlikely that you're going to make it as a really great pianist.
Right. And I don't know if that's the case in football, but I think we're forcing our players that way. The high school football coach looks at the kid in junior high and says, if you want to be a high school player, then I need you to practice year-round. And I don't know that that's good, but that's the way it's going.
Why did you quit playing after just six seasons?
I wasn't a real, real top player, and so I got traded a couple times and kind of got to the end of the line where I could continue to play and try to hang on or, you know, start to work. And I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. Chuck Noll, my coach with the Steelers, called me and said, if you're interested in coaching, I'd like to bring you on the staff. And it was really just a stroke of luck and a blessing for me, because I took him up on it, and I really found that I enjoyed it. Teaching the young guys and being around football was something I enjoyed.
So it was obvious that Chuck Noll saw something in you that maybe you didn't even realize you had?
I didn't realize it. And I think what he saw when they did switch me position-wise, he saw how I worked at it and probably my aptitude at picking up something that I had never done before, but seeing the whole picture. And he was a great teacher and a great mentor for me.
And you became, because you'd played defense, you became a defensive specialist. In baseball, catchers often become good managers because they understand the whole game in a way that other position players don't necessarily. Was it important that you were a safety? A safety kind of covers a wider territory than other defensive players?
Yeah, I think the safeties are like the quarterback on defense, and you see a lot. And also the fact that I wasn't a starter, I wasn't a star player. I was kind of a utility guy, so I backed up a lot of different positions. I had to learn a lot of things about the game, and I think that did help me.
Have you liked coaching more than playing? I get that feeling.
I love coaching, and I like dealing with the players. There's no feeling quite like being out there on the field on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock and actually doing it. But as far as during the week and preparing and seeing a young player come in at 21 years old and see him develop as a person, as a player, and get better at his position and grow as a man, that's really rewarding.
Although we see when a coach is fired, they'll say, well, either he was too tough a disciplinarian and the players did not respond to him, or they say he wasn't tough enough as a disciplinarian. He treated the guys as though they were men. I guess if you succeed, then your way is good, and if you failed, your way is bad. But as a player, you must have thought about what would have made an ideal coach.
Well, I was fortunate. I played for some coaches who were great teachers, and I always felt that I learned the most from them and I played the best for them. Coach Knoll was that way. He, and especially with me, because I was learning as I went, he was always explaining things to me and why you did things. Bill Walsh, I played 1 year for him, and he was very much a strategist and a teacher.
So you worked for the intellectuals.
I did, and I felt that they caused me to flourish, and I just wanted to always coach the way I would like to be coached, the way I'd like my son to be coached. And I think you get a lot more out of players than people realize doing it that way.
But when you're a defensive coordinator, as you were with the Minnesota Vikings, you still have to relate to the head coach.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's your boss. And sometimes I'm sure you've thought, well, this guy's not really doing it the most effective way. But you've got to keep your thoughts to yourself, don't you?
That's part of being a good
soldier.
Do you
think that there are coaches who've worked under you who thought, God, Tony is really screwing up here. He should be doing this a totally different way.
That's normal. You go through that and you say, if I was in charge, I'd do this, and we need to do that. And what I do with my staff, I welcome that. Hey, tell me what your ideas are. Maybe we'll implement it, but don't keep it to yourself. You know, let me know. And then a lot of times you can say to that, well, that's a good idea, but here's the pitfalls of doing it that way.
Now, you're known as a teacher and not a screamer. So what do you think the screamers get out of their players, the Bill Parcells types?
Well, I think you have to be true to your personality, and the players respond to you, and they're going to respond to you. And even the screamers like Bill Parcells, the players know that, hey, it's not personal. That's just the way Bill is. He's correcting me in his way. Tony's correcting me in his way, and we can both probably get the same thing done.
But I remember reading that Peyton Manning, who could have come out of college a year earlier, decided not to because the Giants would have drafted him, and he didn't want to play for Bill Parcells.
Well, that happens at times, too. I'd like to think that if guys had a chance, they would want to play for me.
Tony Dungy is my guest. He's here because he's written a book for kids called You Can Do It, published by Little Simon Inspiration. But you don't mind continuing to talk a bit about football, do you?
No, I love talking about football, as a matter of fact.
When you became the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, they were a terrible team. Their record before was 43-111. They were an expansion team. By the time you left, your record was 54-42 with four playoff appearances. How did you turn them around so fast?
Biggest thing about Tampa was changing the culture from a losing mentality to a winning mentality. And that was hard. Because
the players already had the talent?
There was a lot of talent there, but it was, hey, we've never won. There's always something that's going to go wrong, kind of built-in excuses. And it had a lot of turnover. It never had a consistent way of doing things. And when I went in and talked about, hey, here's how we did it with the Steelers, here's how Coach Knoll won, we're in Minnesota and we won, this is how we're going to do it, you had to sell to the team because they'd heard it from a lot of different coaches, but getting people to buy into your way of doing things, that was really important.
I have a friend who has a theory that sports teams do better, even if the talent level isn't as high, if there's a certain stability, if there isn't constant turnover.
Stability is important, and if you do whatever you do and you continue to do it, you're going to get better at it. If you do something for a year, change philosophies, change course, go a different way, you take two steps forward and one step back. And that's the thing I think we got going, was a consistent way of doing things. Fortunately, we had some young leaders on that team, Warren Sapp, Derek Brooks, Warwick Dunn. Mike Allstott, guys that believed in how I wanted to do it, and they set the bar, and they kind of got everybody else on board.
Well, it was a great defensive team, one of the best ever, and you were somebody who'd come out of the defense. I think people assumed that you brought that to the team, but then when you went to Indianapolis, it was apparent that you have to go with what you have.
You do, and our strength in Indianapolis was offense. We had spent most of our money and the salary cap on the offensive side of the ball. We built that team around Peyton Manning, and so you emphasize the offense a little bit more. But more than anything, it's not whether you're an offensive team or defensive team or you're going to be high-scoring or conservative. It's everybody believing in how you're going to do it and how you're going to win.
Why do you think with that high-powered defense you didn't win a Super Bowl with Tampa Bay?
Well, we got close, and we just didn't make all the plays that we needed to, and we ran into some better teams at times, and it's always not always the best team that wins. Things have to go right for you. I think our Super Bowl team in Indianapolis was probably the fourth most talented team that we've had, but it was the team that played together and had that chemistry you needed to make that final push.
Talked to Plaxico Burress recently, and he said that when he was young and just joined the Steelers, they lost the league championship twice mm-hmm. to the Patriots. And he said some of the veterans were crying. And he said, "Why are you crying? We'll just do it next year." But next year doesn't always work out that way.
That's exactly right. I know I've won my second year in the league as a player, and I thought the same thing. Boy, this is easy. You're going to win every year. It'll be fun getting back to the Super Bowl, and it took me 27 years to get back. So, there's a lot of good teams out there. The competition is tough every year, and things have to go right for you. Injuries, a lot of things play into it.
But only two teams make it to the Super Bowl. So were you surprised in 2002 when you were fired at Tampa Bay?
I was surprised because the way everything played out. You know, we'd had a lot of conversations with my bosses, and we talked about stability and being and going in the right direction. And, I knew that the owners were frustrated because we'd been close in the playoffs but hadn't won it. So it was surprising that way. But that's sports and that's football, that if you don't win, there comes a time when they make a change.
And the guy who replaced you, John Gruden, won the Super Bowl with a team that you pretty much had built.
Well, they went to the Super Bowl the next year, and everyone says, that's what it takes. But that just happened to be their year. We won in Indianapolis a little while later. And it just shows you, if you're competitive and you're up there and it happens to be that perfect storm and things go your way, you've got a chance to win. But the difference between the winners and probably the next 10 teams in the league is very, very slight.
But still, there's always a debate over how important a coach is to a team. You've had winning records wherever you are. You went to the Colts, and you've led them to 73-23 regular season record and a Super Bowl win over Chicago in 2006. So I'm assuming that there are things that you do or you and your staff do that other coaches don't do. Or is it just that you inherited Peyton Manning and lucked out?
Well, we inherited a good team, and we got everybody to buy into our way of doing things. And I've talked to several guys in the NBA. I had dinner with Bruce Bowen, who plays for the San Antonio Spurs, and he played for Pat Riley and Larry Brown and some great coaches. And I asked, "Who's the best coach you played for?" And he said, they're all good. If their star player buys into what the head coach is saying, that's when the guy becomes a great head coach. And in San Antonio, they had David Robinson and Tim Duncan. And so he said that's why Greg Popovich is good. It's not that he's better than everybody else, but he's on the same page with the team.
And when the star goes along with the coach, then the rest of the players follow.
Because he's
kind of like a role model anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, but you did improve the defense at Indianapolis, which had been not that good before you arrived. What can you do other than draft wisely and pick up a couple of free agents?
I think a lot of it is picking players that fit your system and your style and what you want to do. And we've had the good fortune of bringing in a lot of high-quality, tough, hard-nosed players, and they fit what we want to do really well. And then we've been fortunate that our offensive guys have really stayed healthy and blossomed.
And you brought in the system that you had developed in Tampa as the Tampa 2 system. Now it's called the Cover 2 system.
And that system really started back in Pittsburgh in about 1973 or 4. And it's what I learned when I went there as a player. And not that much has changed.
And what happens when coaches who have worked under you move on to become head coaches themselves, like Herman Edwards and Lovie Smith? Do they just simply take that Tampa 2 and call it the whatever, the Lovey 2?
Yeah, for the most part they do, but it's kind of what you said. Everyone has a little different style, and that assistant coach who says, oh, I wish Tony didn't do this way, and they have a chance then to kind of tweak it their style and their way, and so they'll keep a lot of the basic fundamentals, but they'll put their own twist into it.
The New England Patriots had bested your team for years before 2006. Was beating them in the AFC Championship in 2006 more of an accomplishment than winning the Super Bowl?
No, it really wasn't, but it was kind of poetic justice where, they had beaten us so many times in the playoffs and in those big games. We pretty much knew if we were going to win a Super Bowl, we were going to have to beat the Patriots. We finally did beat them that year, and that set up our Super Bowl run.
Some coaches like Bill Belichick will refuse to shake the hands of the opposing coaches after the game. Does that annoy you?
No, it's not personal. Some guys,
they're just so competitive.
They're into it that way and into the moment. And, I've been around Bill Belichick at different places and different functions, and he's always been great with me, in those situations. So I don't really look at that, as anything other than just being very, very competitive and into the moment.
You became the first African-American coach to win the Super Bowl. Was that as important to you personally as the sports commentators made it?
It was. It's something I'm really proud of, and I got a lot of letters from people, a lot of phone calls from people I didn't even know, just saying, this has really been something. I'm glad I got a chance to see it as an African-American, to see your team win it. And I can remember watching Doug Williams when I was a younger guy and Washington winning the Super Bowl and him being a quarterback. I can remember my dad talking about Jackie Robinson playing for the Dodgers. And things like that, they're hard to really overestimate the impact that it has. So it's something I'm really proud of.
But even race aside, you're one of those rare athletes who has been on a winning Super Bowl team as a player and as a coach.
Well, I'm proud of that as well, too. I think I had a very small role in us winning in Pittsburgh, but I did my part to be part of a championship team as a player and then to be part of a championship team as a head coach. It's a special feeling.
How much of an adjustment does a coach have to make to the city that he becomes the coach of? Because there are already football environments in place when you arrive.
It is different. And for me, going to Tampa, as I mentioned, really changing the environment, the thought process of not only the players but the fans. And then when I went to Indianapolis was a basketball town. And I felt it was important that our football team begin to connect with the city and our guys get involved in doing things in the community. And right now the bond between the Colts and the city is really, really strong, and that's something I'm proud of.
And you should be proud that you gave them a much better defense than they had before.
Well, that helps.
I'm looking forward to seeing you when the next book is written and published. But right now, Tony Dungy's latest book is called You Can Do It. It's aimed at kids 4 to 7 with illustrations by Amy June Bates based on his personal experiences and published by Little Simon Inspirations. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Wayne Gretzky has often been called the greatest hockey player in the history of the game, and one sports writer, Ken Clavin, has called him the greatest athlete ever. Gretzky was it makes you laugh, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to hear. Gretzky was skating with 10-year-olds when he was 6, and as a 9-year-old, he was the highest scorer playing in a league of teenagers. He is the only NHL player to total over 200 points in one season, and he did it 4 times. When he retired in 1999, after 20 seasons, he held 61 separate NHL records and holds most of them still, and he remains the leading scorer in the league's history with more goals and more assists than any other player. No wonder he's referred to as the Great One. His new book, 99 Stories of the Game, celebrates the 99th anniversary of the NHL, and is with great pleasure that I welcome Wayne Gretzky to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Sorry, I got a little bit of laryngitis from a lot of talking, but it's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm already a little nervous. And there's so many great athletes. To give that mantle to me is probably not right. But,
well, I didn't say it. This
okay,
guy, Ken Clavins. I'm just quoting.
Yeah, I look at guys like Michael Jordan and Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps, some great athletes. So, you know, that's the great thing about sports. We sit around and we talk, okay, who's the best team and who's the best players and who's the greatest athlete, and we'll never get those answers. But we all think we have the answers, but we'll talk about it forever.
Now, this book celebrates the 99th anniversary of the NHL. Mm-hmm. It didn't start in Canada.
I'm sorry?
Did it start in the United States, not Canada?
The game of hockey?
Yeah, professional hockey.
I'm not sure. I think that it was amateur hockey at the time when they would challenge for the Stanley Cup, which was about 1896.
Ooh.
To about 1916 before they formed what we call the National Hockey League. So you could be in Seattle or in Winnipeg and say, you know what, we challenge you, Winnipeg, to the Stanley Cup. And they would play like a 5 out of 9. And, you know, Winnipeg would get on their dog sleds and go all the way out to Seattle through the Rockies. And they would play a tournament. And the winner would get, at that time, the bowl, which was the cup. And then these owners got together in 1915 and 16 and said, we're going to make this a professional ice hockey league. And the two teams in Canada, Toronto, Montreal, and then, of course, your four American teams was the original. And then they had a seventh team, the Montreal Maroons, which was also in Montreal. It didn't last too long, and that's how we got back to the original six-team league as we knew it for the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
The reason I asked is I heard that the first professional team was in Michigan. It was called the Portage Lakes. Not the best name for a team.
Yeah, but I'm not sure they were actually in the National Hockey League, but they were the first sort of professional team that was getting paid, whether it was $100 a year or whatever it was.
Now, I mentioned that you were playing against 10-year-olds when you were 6. How old were you when you really started playing hockey?
So, for whatever reason, the good Lord chose me, and I don't know why he gave me this special gift, and that was a passion for the game of hockey. So I started skating when I was 2.5. I went to try out for this hockey team, and at that time, the earliest you could play was 10 years old. And I tried out for this team at 5. I made the team, and the coach asked my dad for my birth certificate. And my dad gave it to him, and it showed that I was 5. And he said, oh, my God, he's too young. He can't play. So I remember I was driving home crying because I wasn't allowed to play. And the next year I went up for the team again as a 6-year-old. I made the team. I'd like to tell you all these great stories and how wonderful it was, but I really wasn't that good, and I scored 1 goal in 60 games. But I played on that team for 5 years. And so I don't know why, but I always had a passion not only for hockey, but for all sports.
Were your father and did your father and grandfather also play?
My grandfather was from Belarus, Russia. He did not play. He was in World War I, fought for Canada. My dad was raised, and he played a little bit of hockey. He didn't play a lot. But the things that I learned at a young age in my backyard, on ponds and lakes like other kids, my dad was obviously the most important teacher that I had.
It's been said about you that your great talent is that you see the ice. You have better peripheral vision than most people?
I don't know if it's better. from a young age, I didn't have the speed or the power or that strength that a guy like Gordie Howe had or Bobby Orr. So even at a young age when I was 6 playing against bigger kids, I learned that my hockey sense was going to be my forte. My skill was going to be seeing the ice and be able to recognize the situation and the scenario. So I didn't have to change my game because at 6 when I played against 10-year-olds, I played that way. At 14, I played against 19 and 20-year-olds. And then at 17, I turned pro and played against men. So I had to play the same style from the time I was 6 years old all the way through my career. And I just got to be able to work on my craft for a lot longer than some other guys.
Your father used to ask you to draw the puck as you watched the game on TV,
mm-hmm.
Hockey Night in Canada on the CBC.
Mm-hmm.
Did that train you on how to see the ice?
I think it taught me, A, the game itself, and B, in some ways, it taught me how to have that peripheral vision because, you know, I couldn't just put my pen on the paper and follow the puck because you have to watch the actual TV. And so by watching the TV and then drawing where the puck was going and trying to stay within the limits of that ice rink without really looking down, I think that really helped me and taught me the game itself, the player that I became.
When you were 6 playing the 10-year-olds, was that in a non-checking league?
No, back then, everything was checking.
Were there people concerned about concussions?
There was no... I have a picture of my very first goal, and I've looked at it for many years. I was 6, and my dad actually took the picture, and he happened to be at that spot of the arena. And I've looked at the picture many a time, obviously, over the course of time, and I didn't realize until about 10 years ago, and I scored this goal in 1967, that the goaltender didn't even have a mask on. So the game has changed dramatically.
And nobody was wearing helmets.
We just started wearing helmets at about that time. But even in 1978, when I turned pro in the old WHA, the very first day of training camp, my teammates encouraged me to take my helmet off because helmets were about 10 to 15% in the professional ranks. And I remember I had my helmet off, and my dad had driven down to watch a practice and spend the weekend, and the next day we were playing. And we got to the arena, and I was practicing. All of a sudden, my dad came running down the stands, and I'm thinking, what does he want? And my dad was yelling at me, get your helmet on. Put your helmet back on. And I'm looking at all the players, and I'm like, oh, okay. And I put my helmet back on, and, of course, I wore it the rest of my career. But in those days, helmets weren't part of the game. We just didn't wear them.
In fact, it was grandfathered out into the game that when helmets became became the rule, players who had played without the helmets could choose whether to wear helmets or not.
Yeah, and Craig McTavish was the last player that really played the National Hockey League without a helmet. And I think that we saw the evolution of the helmets, and it came in, and it was the most sensible thing we've done in a long time. And the other thing about it, people would say to me, do you wear a visor? Can you wear a visor? And I would say, you know, I grew up my whole life and I didn't wear one. And these young kids would come to the National Hockey League and I would say to them, why are you taking your visor off? You've worn it your whole life. Your eyes are one of the two of the most protective things that we need to have in your lifetime. Don't take your visor off. And so I would encourage young guys who came into the league. And now, of course, it's the same thing as the helmets. They grandfathered the visor rule, and now each and every guy wears a visor, which absolutely they should.
Is it true that as a 6-year-old you had to tuck in your hockey jersey because it was too big?
Yeah, you know, people ask me, like, when I turned pro and I would tuck my jersey in, they would always say, how did you start tucking your jersey in? Is that superstition? Or I said, no, that was part of my sort of, that was my uniform, because when I made the team at 6, my goodness, I was the size of a normal 6-year-old. And I was playing with kids who were 10. And in those days, they would order 15 jerseys, 1 to 15. And they would hang them in the locker room, and they'd say, okay, here's your number, and here's your jersey. And they're all the same size. So I'm a 6-year-old boy with this 10-year-olds. It came down over my knees. I kid you not. And my dad grabbed me one day, and I can remember, like, yesterday. He goes, you look so small out there. I remember thinking, well, I am 6. And he said, no, we'll tuck your jersey in. So he tucked the jersey in so you could see my legs and my hockey pants. It made me look a little bit bigger. So I carried it out through my whole career that even in the NHL, I always wore a bigger size jersey so I could tuck it in so it wasn't that tight. But it was just part of my uniform.
And when did you become 99?
You know, Gordie Howe, who I always say was the greatest player who ever lived and played, and was just the nicest man also. I idolized him so much. I always wanted to be number nine. So every team I went to, I was always like, can I have number nine? And so when I played junior hockey, I got drafted. Sault Ste. Marie, Canada, went up there to play. And the year before, they had a number nine. And so, of course, that's his number. You can't take it away from him. It's disrespectful, and you don't even go down that avenue. So they gave me number 24, and I played three or four games, and I played pretty well, and I had enough courage to go into the coach at that point in time and say, you know, I don't like my number. And he said, well, how about number 19? And I remember I looked at him, and I said, you know, I don't want number 19. And he said, and he got all flustered and frustrated, and he was this old, big old gentleman, and he was swearing and spitting at me. And I remember sitting there, and he had a big fedora on, and he said, hey, well, why don't you just wear two nines? And I went, yeah, okay, perfect. And he slammed me out of the office. He said, get out. And there was no secret to it. There was no, like, big story. It was just more or less out of frustration. He threw me out of there and said, okay, wear two nines. And in those days, nobody really did that. Esposito wore 77. Ken Hodge had 88. And I was the first young guy to go to that double-digit number. And at that point in time, when I walked out of the office, I can guarantee you that we never thought that that would be sort of one of my legacies, was the number that I wore. That's not why I chose the number, but everybody knows me as number 99 to this day. And when I got traded from Indianapolis to Edmonton in 1978, and I was 17 years old, and I walked in, and Glenn Sather was a coach, and he called me in his office, and he said, you know, you're going to be a young player, and we're going to take pressure off you, and the first thing I'm going to do is we're going to change your number. And, of course, when you're 17 years old and you're in a new team, you're scared to death.
And it's Glenn Sather, and it's Glenn Sather, a great player.
Yeah, I'm looking at him like, okay. So I played that night, and I got a goal and an assist, and I went into him after the game, and I said, you know, I'm going to have a lot of pressure on me. It's not going to matter. Can I have my number 99 back? And he goes, yeah, sure, you can have it back. And so I played one pro game with, I think it was number 26, and then the rest of my career was number 99.
You also a prodigy at being interviewed. How old were you when you did that first interview, the one that had the headline, Hull, Richard, Howe, and Gretzky?
Yeah, that's pressure, isn't it? I think it was a guy's name was John Iaboni, who was a writer for the Toronto Telegram. And I think the late John Bassett was the owner of the Toronto Telegram, who was a wonderful man, and became good friends with him and his family over the years. He came down to Brantford, and he wanted to do this interview on this kid. You know, in those days, the world was so big. You know, we would hear stories of players in 4 hours away or 3 hours away. But, you know, you never really saw them. Or you would hear, this guy's so big for 10 years old. You know, he's like a man, and you'd... So they came down, they said, we want to do this story on you. And my dad said, yeah, you come down and interview him. And I was 10 years old, and we were sitting there, and he got a picture. He took a picture of me lacing my skates up, and he did this whole interview. And I don't think, and I haven't read it in a long time, but I couldn't have answered any question with more than two words. Everything was like, yes, no, okay, yeah, it's okay. So like any other normal 10-year-old. But that was the first national interview I did, and from there it just seemed to grow.
Well, but obviously they had spotted something special in you that they would have even have wanted to do this and to pair you with some of the greatest players in the history of the game.
Somebody said to my dad, don't you think it's too much pressure on this kid? He's only 10 years old. It was a next-door neighbor. And my dad said, he's fine. You know what? You have to embrace pressure. Pressure is part of life. And the great thing about sports is you learn how to prepare, and you learn how to be unselfish, and you learn how to work hard. You learn how to win. You know what it takes when you unfortunately don't win. And so he was a tremendously smart man, and he was the guy that really directed me in the direction and made me the player that I became.
I'm speaking with Wayne Gretzky, who, with the help of Christy McLellan Day, has written 99 Stories of the Game. It is published by, who's publishing this?
Indigo.
It's what?
Penguin.
Penguin, a major publisher. But you never play with the Penguins. We will take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of those 99 stories of the game with Wayne Gretzky.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We're back with Wayne Gretzky, who, with the help of Chrissy McLellan Day, has written 99 Stories of the Game, published by G.P. Putnam, which is a division of Penguin. 99 Stories of the Game because hockey is celebrating its 99th anniversary. And you tell a lot, you explain a lot of the things about that may have, be a little confusing to fans. Simple things like broadcasting at first was broadcast over telegraph.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? We've come so far in the sort of commercial world as far as marketing and promoting our game. I said this recently when I told somebody how great Gordie Howe was, and I said, you know, I was with Gordie Howe in the Plaza Hotel 1978, and I was 17 years old, and every single person I knew, or every single person I saw, knew Gordie Howe and came over to shake his hand and get a picture. And I remember saying to my dad a couple of days later, you know, Gordie wasn't even on TV probably till 1963 or 64, and people, half the people didn't have TVs. It was all by radio. And so the hockey players in Canada from day one were bigger than life. And now that we have so much more exposure with TV and every game's on TV, but that's what I found fascinating about how much Canadians flocked to the game of hockey even before they saw these guys on TV.
Well, didn't Clarence Campbell, the NHL president at the time, vow that hockey would never be televised?
Yeah, he was a big believer that we wanted people to go to the games. But, you know, we, in some ways, sometimes we trip over our own feet. And sometimes we go, well, this is the best way. It's like parenting. You parent differently today than we did 30 years ago. You got to progress with the times. And the times was, we're going to grow our sport and make it more popular across the country and across North America. And TV was a way to let people into the stadiums from coast to coast.
You actually wound up playing with Gordie Howe.
Yeah.
Was that an exhibition game?
No, I was in those days I played in the WHA, which was a rival league, the World Hockey Association.
And you were in that because the NHL, you were too young to play in the NHL?
Yeah, the NHL brought in a rule that you could not play, you couldn't get drafted until 20. They were trying to protect junior hockey. And the rival league, like the ABA, were taking all these young guys at 18 and 19 before the NHL could draft them, because that was the way they felt like, okay, we can be a rival league, get the best young players. So I was in that league, and Gordie Howe and Bobby Hull had solidified that league when they jumped in 72.
Well, they were already old-timers.
Oh, yeah. Gordie was 49 when I played with him, and I was 17, and I didn't expect to play at all. And we had this coach named Jacques Demers who went on to coach the Montreal Canadiens and win a Stanley Cup there. I walked in the locker room, and Jacques said to me, kid, you're going to center Mark and Gordie. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, oh, Lord. He goes, is that okay? I said, yeah, I guess that's okay. And so,
answer is pass.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is very funny because I was sitting there, and my jersey was way too big. They'd made it like four sizes too big. And I said, Gordie, my jersey's too big. And he got up and he went and got a needle and a thread and grabbed my jersey and he sewed the side of it to make it smaller on the one side with this thread. And I still have the jersey. And I remember thinking, how is this happening? The greatest player ever is sewing my jersey. And so I'm sitting there And of course, I was so nervous. You know, when you're 17 years old, you're playing an all-star game, you're playing with the greatest player ever, your idol. And I remember sitting there and I was tying up my skates and I kind of was looking at Gordy out of the corner of my eye. And I said, Gordy, I'm so nervous. And I looked over and Gordy was sitting, leaning back against the wall. And he had his eyes closed like he was sleeping. And he opened his one eye and he said, so am I. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, right. And so I got to play with him. And then in 1980, when he came back to the National Hockey League as a Hartford Whaler, they played one of the greatest all-star games ever. And he was the last player introduced. It was one of the first times he'd been back to Detroit to play in the NHL. And he got a standing ovation. And I remember thinking, if the PA announcer didn't get on, they would still be cheering to this day because that's how much he was loved. And I had chills that went through my body. And I remember thinking, I'm so proud of the fact that I'm part of this to see this because people wouldn't believe how wonderful it was.
Well, he's playing at 50. In fact, he played on a line with his sons. That seems almost impossible physically because hockey is a sport that where you get hurt a lot, and you got hurt a lot.
It was a different game back then. There's no question, and I say this all the time, the game's better today than when I played because the athletes are better. They're bigger, they're faster, the equipment's better, the coaching's better.
But there still are fights in pretty much every game.
No, not as much anymore. We're slowly, you know, if you go to youth hockey, when I was a kid, kids fought. And then junior hockey, kids fought. Now, if you fight at that age, you're automatically ejected from the game. So we're slowly eliminating the fighting from hockey because these kids grow up, they don't know how to fight. And so we're slowly eliminating fighting from the game. And I think the game is wonderful today. But as you said, can you imagine 50 years old? I think he got 15 goals that year at 50 years old, which to me is remarkable.
In your chapter on the Bing Cup, you describe what you call one of the oldest tricks in the book, calling for a drop pass when you're a defender. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that?
You know, because everybody gets so nervous when they're playing, especially young guys. And the game is so fast that there's not a whole lot of talking goes on. So when you do holler for things, if a guy doesn't see you, he'll leave the puck and away you go the other way. So it was something that happened to me a few times, and I used it a few times.
The reason I mentioned the Bing Cup is it was created in the hopes of making the game less violent.
Yeah, and I think here's the thing about the game of hockey. Whether you like it or not, it's a physical presence. It's a demanding presence because it's physically and mentally difficult to play. And as you alluded to earlier, when you said to me, was I in a checking league at 6? What we've done now is we've taken some of the checking out, I think it's to the age of 12 or 13, which I think is really good. And then what I'd like to see happen is that you have two different leagues because there's kids who love to play that don't want to be part of the body checking. And it's okay to play in that league where there's no hitting. But the bottom line is to be a professional NHL player, physical side of the game is always going to be part of it. That's why it's so hard to lift the Stanley Cup. Because it's physically demanding. It's mentally draining. It's difficult.
Let's talk about the Stanley Cup. Huh? Who was Lord Stanley?
I think he was a gentleman from England that donated it to some guys who wanted to play a challenge cup. And that's sort of how the Stanley Cup started. It started as a bowl. And we grew to this Stanley Cup as we know it today. And one of the great parts of our game is the trophies that we have, the history of our game. And the Stanley Cup, and I think the first time it was actually presented was like 1896. And that's when I said when they would challenge for it. And I think you could win it two or three times in a season. So it wasn't like one team had it for a year. And then the trophies that we have, the Jack Adams Trophy, the Art Ross Trophy, the Norris Trophy, those are all trophies that our game we're so proud of because they've been around for so long.
What do you remember about winning your first Stanley Cup?
Oh, you know, as kids when we grow up, all we talk about, when you're playing floor hockey or ball hockey, backyard on the pond hockey, everybody was always, I'm Gordie Howe or I'm John Beliveau, and that's a Game 7 Stanley Cup winning goal, and we just won the Stanley Cup. And for most kids, it's always just going to be a dream. Very few people get the privilege and the honor to play in the National Hockey League. And so when you play in the league, your first thought is, gosh, I love it here. I want to stay in here. And then once you get your feet wet, and once you get sort of to a point where, okay, I belong in this league, your thought process turns to, I want to win that Stanley Cup. And so the first time you lift the Stanley Cup, and this is the thing about the cup, you don't really touch it or lift it until you win it. So, of course, there's jubilation and there's excitement and it's overwhelming. But when the commissioner actually hands you the trophy, you don't realize what you're lifting up. The trophy, I believe, is 37 pounds. It's a little heavier than people think, and especially the guy who's getting it. So if you're fortunate enough to win it more than once, by the third and fourth time, you got an understanding to what you're actually lifting up, and it really is the greatest trophy.
Now, the Oilers won 4 Stanley Cups, and 5.
Yeah.
And they were a new team. Usually new teams that are introduced into an established league don't do all that well. I guess the only other exception was the Cleveland Browns in football. But was it because you had younger players?
Oh, I think
there was a dynasty there.
I think the architect deserves a lot of credit. And Glenn Sather had a vision in 1979 that he was going to build his team differently than other new teams had done, where other new teams would grab older players that they thought would sort of be the guys that could go to another level. He didn't want to do that. His theory was, I'm going to put as many 18-year-olds on this team that I believe can play at this level and put experienced professional NHL guys around those players to teach them what it's like, how you have to practice hard every day, to teach them what it takes to win. And so he brought these guys in like Colin Campbell and Lee Fogle and Dave Dryden, Ken Dryden's brother. And he worked. It worked in a sense that those guys taught guys like Messier and Coffey and Gretzky and Anderson and Fuhr. And so we kind of grew up together. And by the time we got to be 22, 23, after 3 or 4 years, we got to the Stanley Cup Finals, and believe me, we thought we knew everything. And before we knew it, the Islanders beat us 4 straight. And all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, what just happened? And the group of people that we had took from that a certain amount of respect that we gained from the Islanders to how good they were with guys like Billy Smith and Potvin and Trottier, Bossy, to what it took to go from being a good team to being a great team. And people forget this a little bit, that the Islanders kind of went through that trial and tribulation in 78 and 79, and then they got over their hump in 80. Well, we went through that in 82 and 83, and we got over our hump in 84. But we always said our respect for the New York Islanders and what they accomplished, that's what took us to another level.
Are the Oilers responsible for the NHL's creation of the job of keeper of the cup?
Oh, 100%. I think up until we won in 84, it sort of was, you won the Stanley Cup, and there was sort of a family and friends and team get-together, and the Stanley Cup sort of sat in the owner's office and that sort of thing. And we had this 2.5-3 hour celebration after winning the Stanley Cup. And we're all in the locker room, and of course there's bedlam and family, friends, and media, and then people we didn't even know somehow got in there. But as we were showering, getting ready, we were going next door to the convention center, and I was by myself with my dad, and the Stanley Cup was sitting there. And I was standing there, and you know, when you've never won it, you don't know what transpires or what goes on. And I remember Glenn was there, and I said, Glenn, what do we do with the Stanley Cup? He said, you guys want it, take it. And we did. We took it everywhere. And by the fourth year, they said, geez, we better put somebody in charge of this cup. And now they do a thing where a guy takes it and you get it for a day. But back in those days, we just kind of took the cup. It was ours.
Then you left the Oilers. You were kind of bought. They said it was a trade, but it really was a bought.
It was really a sale. Yeah. And listen, when it happened, it was devastating for everyone. For the ownership of the Oilers, for the fans, for me. And I look back at it now, and I have way more of an understanding of where the Oilers owner was coming from and what he had, was kind of going through his mind. And at the end of the day, him and I are still friends. And, you know, it's always, as I say, the one city that I hated playing in as a visiting player was Edmonton. I never got comfortable. I never liked it, partly because I had so many great memories there, so many wonderful times. And more importantly, the fans treated me so well in Edmonton that I hated being the enemy. So I never got comfortable going back there. But as life, everything happens for a reason, and I ended up in L.A., and it was, you know, unfortunately we got to a final and didn't quite get over that hump, but it was an experience that I always loved.
And L.A. was owned by Bruce McNall, not your typical NHL hockey team owner.
No, he was definitely flamboyant, and he is definitely a different owner. He felt excited about promoting the game, and he wanted the game to get bigger. And I remember he used to bring Michael Eisner to the games all the time. And Michael Eisner would come to the games, and Michael Eisner and his kids fell in love with ice hockey. And I remember one day Mr. Eisner said to me, you know, I'm going to do this hockey movie. And I said, oh, yeah, what is it? And he said, it's going to be called The Mighty Ducks. And I remember thinking, okay, that's really not going to go anywhere, but how do you argue with a guy who runs Disney? And as it turns out, the movie became the success. And then he said, you know, I want to put a team in Anaheim and call them the Mighty Ducks. And I remember Bruce McNall could have taken a sort of a waiver fee for being close in a proximity to L.A. and Anaheim and felt like the Ducks were going to be important to the future of the National Hockey League. And Michael Eisner loved hockey. He bought the hockey team, put them in the National Hockey League, and the rest is history.
And Bruce McNall changed the colors of the Los Angeles Kings. What led him to do that?
You know, I think the big thing was when Jerry Buss had, well, originally Jack Kent Cooke went to L.A., built the Fabulous Forum, owned the Los Angeles Lakers. He bought the NHL expansion team, the L.A. Kings, and everything was gold and purple. And it worked for the L.A. Lakers. They went on to be a storied franchise. Well, during that same time, the gold and purple or purple and gold didn't have a whole lot of success. So when Bruce took over, one of the things he wanted to do was sort of separate the Laker-Kings sort of scenario. And he felt like he wanted to give their own identity to the Los Angeles Kings. And so he chose to go with, at that time, the L.A. Raiders, the black, silver, and white colors.
Hmm. Well, you had hoped to win a Stanley Cup with the Kings, but then you were injured.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get the back injury?
You know, we don't officially know. I got hurt in 1991 at some point in time. I spent 4.5 months with what we thought was a cracked rib or a strain of a muscle. But it was excruciating pain. And as it turned out, it was referred pain from a chip that I had in my upper back. I went and met with the doctor, and he told me that if I did surgery, I'd be out for 18 months and maybe my career would be over, because nobody'd ever, there was only one other athlete that we could find professionally that had done a thoracic disc surgery and come back. Mm. So I chose to go the way of doing therapy. I did therapy for 4.5 to 5 months. I got stronger and better. Unfortunately for me, the chip kind of dissolved, and I really didn't have any more issues after that. I missed 41 games.
But getting back into the swing of things can be difficult because not up to the standards that you were when you were hurt, but they still have to play you.
Yeah, and when I did come back, I was horrible for the first 15 games. Because you're getting everybody at mid-season form, and you're coming in, and it doesn't matter, and I tell this to people all the time, you got to work out, and you got to train, and it's good, but the way professional athletes train compared to the average person is completely different. And it's the same as training for a professional athlete. It's one thing to train, it's another thing to participate in the actual game. So it took me time to come back and get into the flow, but as it turned out, when I did come back, one of the great things about it was when I finally did get caught up, come April and May when we were in the Stanley Cup playoffs, I was physically and mentally stronger than I'd been in a long time because I had had that window of time off to be able to regroup and get myself ready.
But then you broke a rib.
And then I cracked a rib. Yeah, but that's part of the
game.
Played
with the cracked rib.
That's part of the game. You know, a lot of guys do it. I'm not the only guy that's ever done it. and there'll be more guys in the future.
I have to tell you that one of the complaints that New Yorkers had when in the earlier days was that the Montreal Canadiens had a leg up because they had territorial rights. They had the first pick of the two best players from the area, the Quebec area. The fix was in.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if they call it a fix, but the Montreal Canadiens have more power than the New York Rangers. And one of the greatest things about our game today, and the commissioner and the Players Association did, was we have a salary cap. And so the New York Rangers are on the same playing field as the Dallas Stars. And it gives us parity in the National Hockey League and an opportunity for each and every team from Miami to Vancouver to have a chance to win the Stanley Cup. And that's all fans want.
And the territorial rule no longer exists. In effect. 99 Stories of the Game, written with the help of Kirsty McLellan Day and published by Putnam, which is a division of Penguin. It's been a great honor having you on our show.
I love being here. You're a wonderful man. Thank you.